Morning, everybody. How are we doing? Good? All right. Well, that story that you just heard behind that video is beautiful. Isn't that beautiful? It's a beautiful story, and not just the narrator's voice, although that was silky smooth, too. It was me. That was me. I was the narrator. But that story is beautiful. I actually believe that it's the most beautiful story in all of that library of books that we call the Bible. I think it's the most beautiful one, and it's Genesis chapter 1. And I think no matter who you are in this room today, and no matter what your standing is with God, no matter what your belief in God is, you know, maybe you're in this room and you follow God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind. And maybe you're in this room today and for the first time in your life, you've started to question some things and it feels like the foundation might be shaking a little bit. And maybe you're in this room today and you're pretty sure that the whole thing's made up. None of it's real. I think no matter where you stand in that, no matter what you think of the Christian faith, we can all come to a common agreement that in and of itself, that story is beautiful. And it's beautiful stylistically. You know, it's beautiful because of its language and poetry and prose. And it's beautiful because of its imagery and where it takes us as it paints this picture. And it's beautiful because of its message. And I think that the most beautiful thing about this story, I think the most beautiful thing here is its location. Because that story is page one of the Bible. That's where it all starts. This is where it starts, and this is where we begin. And not only is it beautiful that you start with this message of hope and beauty and goodness, but I think that it's important that you start here because, to me, it matters where you start. It matters where you start. Where you start matters because your starting point is your orientation as to the journey that you're about to take, right? Your starting point is how you orient yourself. If you think about somebody asks you how to get somewhere, your first question to them should be, where are you starting from? Because that orients you as to what the journey will look like. And I've been given like certain gifts in this life, and I've been given certain deficiencies that I have to work through. And one of the deficiencies that's like most glaringly obvious for me is that I have a comically bad sense of direction. People think I'm joking. Like people get in cars with me and they think I'm doing a bit. They're like, you can't possibly be lost in this place that you live. But I am, always. I mean, imagine living your life and 90% of the time not knowing where you are geographically. It's exhausting. It's hard. I had to use a GPS to get to a place that I've already been to. And then once I turn it off, I lose my orientation. And when I get back in the car to return home, I have to turn the GPS back on to get back to the same place I just came from. That's not an easy life. The struggle is real. The struggle is real. And I've dealt with that my whole life. And to be honest with you, you know, I've been saved from this deficiency somewhat because of smartphones, right? So I have multiple mapping devices on this phone, and I don't ever get lost anymore as long as I don't run out of battery, okay? I had a friend who's in the military, and he was telling me that when they do basic training, they do wayfinding, and so they take you out into the desert or something, and they make you find and orient yourself using physical landmarks and demarcations so that without a compass, without a map, without a smartphone, you can find where you're going. And he was like, he was telling me this, and I was just laughing at him. I was like, that sounds impossible. That sounds impossible. And he was like trying to level with me and be kind. And he was like, well, picture this, John. What if we dropped you in the middle of the woods and you knew that all you had to do was walk east and you would find your way to civilization? What would you do? And I don't know what he was expecting me to say, but I was like, okay, so I go. I would die in the woods. I would die in the woods, and I would have gone south on accident, and I would have been died ashamed and afraid. So don't drop me in the woods, because I won't make it out. I won't make it out. Thank goodness for smartphones. Now, when I first learned how to drive, which is when you start to understand whether or not you understand directions, I didn't have a smartphone. It was right before smartphones. I had a Motorola Razr, which was sick, but it wasn't a smartphone. And didn't have a GPS on it. And some cars had GPSs in their dashboard, but I had an 89 Nissan. And my 89 Nissan had a speedometer that didn't work. A 16-year-old with a speedometer that doesn't work. Like an officer pulls me over, they're like, do you know how fast you were going? I'm like, actually, I've never known. My whole life, I've never known how fast I'm going. And I had a gas gauge that didn't work. It was always on empty, even if you filled it up. So I was like calculating in my mind, like I know how to do that, whether I have enough gas to get to. Anyways, all that to say, no GPS in the dash. So what would I do? I would get lost all the time. All the time. I was lost in Olentangy, in Lewis Center, home of the Braves. What's up? Lost in a planned suburb. It's a place that's like a loop. You're not supposed to get lost there. And when I would get lost, I'd have to call my father because he's like a real man and knows how to like find directions and stuff. I'd tell him where I was going or how I got lost, and he'd help orient me back to get me back on the right path. And what I started to realize was that I had a certain amount of shame involved in this deficiency. Like, first of all, I don't like not being good at things. So like that's a first problem. And then secondly, there's this weird cultural thing that we do where we say that men are supposed to be good with directions and women are supposed to be bad with directions. So people would make jokes and I'd be like, yeah, totally, dude. Women, right? I've never met a woman who has a worse sense of direction than me in my whole life. So I'm like, kind of have some shame in this thing that I'm doing. So I didn't want anybody to know, especially if they were in the car with me. So what I did was I started to memorize routes, right? Like instead of trying to understand where you are in relation to other things, I would just memorize the step-by-step directions. So like to get to school, you turn left here and right here and left here and right there. And you still don't really know where you are. You just know the route to get there. So I had routes memorized from my house to school, from my house to my friend's house, from my house to the baseball field, from my house to the mall, to the movie theater. And it all worked perfect until you changed the starting point. Right? Until you change the starting point. When I don't start at my house, I lose my orientation. I no longer know how to get to this place. And so I would like call my dad and be like, Dad, will you help me get to school? And he's like, what do you mean get to school? You go to school every day. You don't know where your school is? I'm like, well, I'm starting somewhere else. And like to somebody who understands direction and wayfinding, that makes no sense. He's like, just go to the school that you go to every day. I'm like, I can't, Dad, help. And when I changed my starting point, I lost my orientation. I became disoriented. I didn't know how to get to where I was supposed to go because where you start, it affects your journey, right? If you start in a different place, the journey starts to look different. And the reason I want to talk about this today is because, you know, there's this little secret that sometimes we're bad at explaining in Christianity, that your faith is a journey. The whole thing is a journey. Everything is a journey. It's not like you journey for a while and then you get there. It's not like you struggle and wrestle through doubt and that's the journey and then eventually you get there. That's not how it works. The whole thing is a journey. And in evangelical Protestant Christianity, we have this bad habit because we say that we get saved, that like that's the whole deal. You say it and you pray it and then you're saved and the rest is just gravy. But we know that that can't possibly be true, right? Like you know that can't possibly be true if it's a relationship. If your relationship with God is a real relationship, then going into the relationship is not the end line and everything else is gravy. That's just the beginning of a relationship. And so you enter and you walk. It would be like saying that when you say your vows, right, when you say I do, that that's the finish line and everything else is just gravy on top. And you know that's not true if you've been married. That's the beginning. And then the rest of your faith or the rest of your marriage is you walking and journeying with this person and you giving yourself to them and them giving themselves to you and you starting to understand each other and know each other. And yet as you start to know each other, you start to uncover the depth and complexity of their humanity and how much you don't know and how much you might not ever know. And so you continue to journey, and that's why it's a journey. 3 years into my marriage with my wife, Jenna, I learned that she likes roses. It's her favorite flower. 3 years into marriage, that's good. And we dated for 7 years before we got married. It took me 10 years to find out what kind of flowers my wife likes. And her middle name is Rose. And her mother's name is Rose. So context clues are tough. And, you know, the mysteries that are revealed to us, right? And if that's true of a relationship with a person, then how much more true will that be of a relationship with a God that we believe created everything? A God who even our descriptions of him and who he is simply an approximation of what we believe he is. And so you walk with God and you journey with God and he's next to you and you get to know him and he reveals himself to you. And yet, the more you know, the more you start to understand how much you don't know about him. The mystery and the wonder and the awe of being in a relationship with the creator of the universe. And as you go through this journey, you're asking yourselves some of the deepest questions and longings of your soul. Questions like purpose, what is it? What's the meaning of all this? Am I valuable? Why? So if you're wrestling through these questions with this God, you've signed yourself up for quite a journey. And if it's a journey, then I think it really matters where we start. It matters how we orient ourselves to God, how we orient ourselves to each other, and how we view ourselves. And so I think it's important that we need to start where it all starts. And here's what I'm getting at. I think that in the Christian world, a lot of times, we don't start at Genesis 1 in that beautiful story of creation and beauty and goodness. A lot of times, I think that we start two chapters later. We start two chapters later, and that is the way that we orient our faith. And two chapters later is Genesis chapter 3. And if you are familiar with the scriptures, this is a moment, the tragedy, the turn in the plot, the story that we call the fall. And so what happens in Genesis is these humans who are here so that they can take God's character, reflect it to the world, and then take the beauty of God's creation and reflect it back to him in worship, decide that instead of worshiping the creator of things, we will worship created things. And when you make ultimate, or when you make created things ultimate things, it destroys your soul. And that's true today, and it was true then. And when it happens, sin and death and brokenness enter into the world. And it is serious, and it is something that must be dealt with. It is something that we have to understand. But if you start with sin, your whole faith will be about removing that sin. If you start with sin, the things that are bad and wrong with you and bad and wrong with other people, your faith, your walk with God will be about, how do I get this thing off of me? How do I expel this sin? How do I expunge this from my being? And everything will start to move that way because you've oriented yourself like that. And as a Christian, believing that Jesus is the Christ and the Messiah and the Savior, you will think of that in terms of what that means for your sin and for your sin only, because we've oriented ourselves that way. And I think that, you know, this is a tragically incomplete picture of what it means to be a human, of what it means to be a Christian, of what it means to be a Jesus follower. I think that if we start in Genesis chapter 3, man, we have some pieces right, but we do not have the holistic picture. It's incomplete because we started two chapters too late. So what I want to do today is I want to go through Genesis chapter 1 and maybe expand our understanding of our purpose and our meaning and who we are and what it means to be a human on this earth in this moment, in this city, right here, right now, in the present time, and hopefully it changes the way that we think about ourselves and about Jesus and about the people around us. And so in order to do this, we have to start where it all starts. I mean, we got to go back past Genesis chapter 3. We got to go back to Genesis 1 and that story you just heard. And in order to do this well, we have to kind of today for the next 20 minutes unshackle yourselves of all of the modern debates that have hijacked the beauty of this story. Okay, if you walk away from this and your main question and takeaway is this the literal account of the material creation of the world told by an ancient Hebrew person? You missed it. You already missed it. You already missed it. You will, by looking through that lens, miss the beautiful things that God is saying and the beautiful things that God is up to when he says them. And so free yourself from all of that and let's just read what it says and what it means about us and about God, all right? So Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Now, my whole life I thought that the creation narrative in the Christian story was all about God creating something out of nothing. I thought the whole thing was about God snapping his fingers and this nothingness turning into something. But, you know, just to be clear, I do think that that happened. I do think that happened. But that's not what this story is about. This story is about something different. And let me show you how I know that, because after the very first sentence, the next sentence says, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. And so after the first sentence of the Bible, the world, the earth is here. It's here. Now it's without form and void, but it's here. So the story of Genesis 1 is not a story about God going around and creating something out of nothing. It's a story about what he does to a formless and void earth. And what's he doing to it? I think in order to understand what he's doing to it, we have to understand what without form and void means, because that's not like an insult that we use to like describe like a sandwich or a person that we don't like. What does it mean to be without form and void? In the original language, in the Hebrew, it's a wilderness term. And it's a term that you can actually remember because it rhymes, so it's nice. Tohu vavohu, without form and void. Tohu vavohu. And tohu vavohu is a Hebrew word that means an unrestrained, chaotic wilderness environment. All right, so God is hovering over these chaos waters, unrestrained wilderness, disorder rules. And because it's defined by chaos and disorder, life cannot flourish on this earth. So the earth that God is hovering above is a chaotic, disordered, dark world where life can't flourish. And so the point, the story, is what he starts to do to this tohu vavohu world. And what does he start to do? What's he start to do to this formless and void world of chaos and disorder? Well, he starts to separate things. He starts to organize things. He takes light, separates it from dark. He creates days. He creates nights. He creates seasons and patterns and predictability. He separates land from water, creates different ecosystems for each, but work in symbiosis with each other. What's he doing? What's God doing to this world? He's like a gardener. He's cultivating it. Right? He's like a gardener who's cultivating this earth. He's taking this place that has that is defined by chaos and disorder and darkness, and he is cultivating order and beauty and goodness out of it. This place where life can't flourish, and he's making it a place where life can flourish. He's preparing it. He's gardening. He's cultivating. You ever wonder all the times that he says good in this story? Like, it was good, it was good, it was good. Well, what was good? Well, it was good for life. Every time he does something that was good for life to sustain and flourish, he says it was good. And so the story of Genesis chapter 1 is a story of God like a master gardener cultivating this earth that is defined by disorder and chaos and making it a world of beauty and goodness and order so that life can flourish. And that, to me, is so much more interesting and so much more beautiful than my idea of God going around and snapping things into existence for no reason, because it shows his purpose in this. And it's really important because of what he does next. Because what he does after he creates this world is, on the sixth day, at the peak of his creative powers, at the height of his creative prowess, he creates humans. He creates humans. That is God's expression of his ultimate creativity, is you and me. He creates humans. And this is what he says about him. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. And the reason that this phrasing is odd and hard to kind of flow with is because it's poetry. This is a poem. This is Hebrew poetry. And in Hebrew poetry, repetition means emphasis. So when you repeat things, you're making an emphatic point. Now, what is the point that the author here is trying to make to you and me? I think it's two things that he keeps repeating: that we are created, humans are created by the Creator, and that we're created in his image. That we, humans, are images of God. Now, image of God, to me, is a very churchy word. It's like a churchy phrase. It's a Christianese. And before I ever understood what it meant, I heard it hundreds of times. Image of God, image of God, image of God. You're an image of God. She's an image of God. He's an image of God. But what does that mean? What's it mean to be an image? Is it like something that is attached to me? Is it something that God gives me? Is it something that I have to earn? What's it mean to be an image of the Creator God? Well, in the Hebrew, the word image is the word tselem. And tselem means idol, which freaked me out the first time I learned this, because idol to me was always a bad thing. You like weren't supposed to deal with idols. But an image of God is an idol of God. And so in every ancient religion, the people would carve images or representations of their gods. And ancient people aren't stupid. Sometimes we think they are. They're not stupid. Ancient people did not think this wooden statue was their god. They thought that it represented their gods. And so they would pray to it. And they would worship it. They would sacrifice to it. And they would take it. And they would mark their holy spaces with it. Temples, high places. And so what does God do at the apex of his creative powers? He creates his own images, his own idols, his own representations of himself. And it's you, and it's the person sitting next to you, and it's me. We're the representations of God in this world, and he takes us and he places us in his holy space, which in this story is a garden that will go on to be called Eden, but it represents the whole world. It represents the world. And so in the beginning, God creates this beautiful place, and he marks it as holy and sacred. And what does he mark as holy and sacred? The whole world. In the creation story, Heaven and earth are overlapped, and the whole thing's a temple. The whole world is God's holy space, and we are his representations that mark it. And that would, like, be enough for me. But then he goes on, and this is where it really gets interesting. He goes on from here, and he doesn't just make us. He says something to us. Here's what he says. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. What's he telling humans to do? Be fruitful, multiply, subdue, have dominion. What was God doing at the beginning? He was cultivating. He was gardening. Out of the raw potential of the earth, he was pulling out of it order and beauty and goodness. And then he creates his representations, he puts them on the earth, and he tells them to do the exact same thing. Further, bring order and beauty and goodness out of the raw and latent potential of this earth. The representations were made representatives, and they were given a task. Take this garden and cover the whole globe with it. Take this garden and cover the globe with it. Now, I wish that somebody would have told me this. Now, you might have already known this. I wish somebody would have told me this when I was wrestling through my faith, because I really, really cared if it was true. Man, I really wanted to know, is this true? Does it make sense? Should I believe this? If it's true, I want to follow it. But it was like an intellectual proposition to me. And the whole time, I had this pit in my stomach that was like, do I even want this to be true? Do I even want this to be true? Because it sounds boring. If it's true, yeah, I'll follow it, but it sounds boring. The people that I know who are Christians and the institutions that represent Christianity seem like they want to take this world and move it backwards. They want to go back to some nostalgic golden age, and all the progress and all the forward momentum and all the movement is happening out there. Do I want to be a part of this thing that wants to go backwards, or do I want to be a part of that thing that wants to go forwards? And I wish that somebody would have told me this story and shown me this, because what this story says is that from the very beginning, God's creation is going somewhere. This is not a static world. This is not a stagnant place that we live. God's creation is going somewhere, and always, 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 his images are the ones who are supposed to take it there into his better future, into his better world. You see, if you're an image of God, man, your job is not to find your place in a static world and exist. Your job is to find your calling in a dynamic world and take it there. And I can prove that this is true, because at the very end it says, and God saw all that he had created, and behold, it was very good, right? It was good, and then it was good, and then it was good, and good, and good, and then he created humans, and it was very good. Why? Well, think about it. In God's good creation, an apple falls from the tree, and its seeds spill on the ground. And maybe the wind picks the seeds up and blows them, and maybe some of those seeds find good soil. And maybe some apple trees grow, and more apple trees happen, and it's good. It's good. But you put a human, one of God's representatives, in charge of that tree, and what might he do? We might take this apple and the seeds in it, and he might plant rows of apple trees, and he might cultivate and take care of the soil. He might provide irrigation. He might create an apple orchard. And that apple orchard might be able to feed a village and sustain life for generations. Why? Because God's images took what was good and made it better. They took what was good and made it very good. That's what it means to be a human. But very good is not perfect. It's not the same thing as perfect. It's not the same thing. Christians a lot of times think that in the garden it was perfect, and then it got broken and it wasn't perfect. That doesn't say that in the text. It says it was very good. And the reason it was very good and not perfect is because we were never supposed to just bask in a garden in the glory of God. We were always supposed to represent him and take the world into his better future. That's what it means to be a human. That's what it means to be you and me. Now, the implications of this to me are massive, and it's something that's worth wrestling with, and it should make us a little uncomfortable. Because first of all, being an image of God is not something that you get to choose to be. It's not like an attachment that he attaches to the human species. It's not something that he gives us to possess. It's not something that you can walk in or step out of. Being an image of God is literally what it means to be a human. It's not an attachment to us. It is definitive of who you are. You are a human, and so you're an image of God. If you're an image of God, then you are a human. That's how this works. And if it's true of who we are identity-wise, then it is true of who you are purpose-wise. And what I mean by that is that taking the world somewhere is not something you get to choose to do. It's not something you choose to do. Because you're a human, because you're an image, and because the task has always been, you know, you are taking the world somewhere. You have this holy and sacred energy in your soul that defines you, in your bones. When you touch the things around you, they transform. And when you move into relationships and out of them, the people are never the same. When you move into situations and then come out of them, those situations are never the same. Why? Because it's who you are. Because you're a human. You're an image. And the things that you touch change and move. And you can use that power and that energy and that sacred responsibility, and you can cultivate order and beauty and goodness, and you will take the world there. Or you can abuse that power, and you can destroy and exploit, and you will take the world there. Either way, you're taking the world somewhere. Why? Because you're you. Because you're a human. Because you are, by definition, possessing this power. And the things that you touch change. And your job is to move the world into a better future. Taking the world somewhere is not something that you choose to do. It's something God has chosen to do through you. He has chosen to set the world up this way. You can get mad at that. You can wish that he didn't do that, because humans have proven to be good at making a mess of things. You can wish he didn't set it up that way, but according to Genesis chapter 1, he did. Why? I'm not sure, but he did. From the beginning, it's always the way that he has chosen to move his purposes through this world, to take what we have and to make it better. That's what it means to be a human. That's what it means to be you. That's what it means to be an image. You are in charge, co-ruling God's good creation on his behalf, and the task is to take it somewhere better. Now, the question, because, you know, honestly, that's not what it means to be a Christian. That's what it means to be a human. Not what it means to be a Christian. That is what Genesis chapter 1 tells us it means to be a human. That's you as a human. So the question that you guys should be asking right now, you're in a Christian church, right? And what we believe is that Jesus Christ fulfilled all this stuff that happened before him. So the question is, what does this have to do with Jesus? What does this have to do with Jesus? And to me, the reason that this changed my life when I learned it is because it oriented me into my relationship with Jesus about what it was. It gave me the right starting place, and so my disorientation became all of a sudden clear, and I started to see what I think all of this means. And here's what I'm getting at. If you start in Genesis chapter 3, you start with the fall, and you start with sin, and that's the beginning, then your whole faith will be about getting rid of that. And if you believe that Jesus saved you and redeemed you and healed you, then all that you really believe is that a transaction occurred on the cross, right? Cha-ching. Sin gone, transaction. Your faith becomes transactionary. Who Jesus is to you is simply someone who came and something that happened to him that ridded you of your sin. There's this bad thing about you that gets taken away. But if you start where we should start, if we reorient ourselves to the story that I just read to you, Genesis chapter 1, then it becomes not really what defines you is not the fall. What defines you is the original purpose that we were always supposed to have. The original purpose that we were always meant to carry out into the world. The thing that we were supposed to be in the garden is maybe the thing that through Jesus we're supposed to do today. Maybe we're restored and redeemed all the way back to that. And when you look at the Gospels and the life of Jesus through this lens, man, it will change you. It will shake you. You will get freaked out about some of the stuff that the writers wrote. You'll be like, did he really write that? Is he that bold to write that about Jesus? And let me show you one of these, because it's fascinating. In the book of John, chapter 20, John was one of the disciples of Jesus. And he walked with Jesus, and he knew Jesus, and he loved Jesus. And when Jesus dies, which is right before this, there's no Jesus movement anymore. So messiahs don't die, and failed messiahs die all the time, and usually on the cross in Rome. So there was no Jesus movement here, and there was no Jesus followers anymore, but Jesus had friends who were close to him, man, people who loved him, people who, because he died, are mourning his loss. And so his friend, Mary Magdalene, one of his earliest disciples and followers, goes to the tomb where he was buried, which was in a garden outside of where he was killed. And she goes there to mourn and weep because her friend has died. And when she gets there, she sees that the tomb is open. And she thinks that someone's stolen the body because people don't raise from the dead. It's not like you're expecting to see that. And so she's weeping because someone's stolen the body. And like, what are they doing with it? Why do they have it? Are they like denigrating it? What are they doing to this body? And so she's weeping. And as she's weeping, she turned around and saw Jesus, but she did not know that it was Jesus. And he said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" And supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where, and I will take him." And Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him, "Rabbi, teacher." And if you've been taught the story before, you've probably been shown that when he calls her by name, she sees him for who he is. And Jesus calls all of us by name, and that is a beautiful truth. But that is not really what is going on here. That's not really what's crazy and trippy about this story. The thing that's crazy about this story is that she thinks he's a gardener. Mary sees Jesus, and she thinks he's a gardener. Why? Because on the first day of the week, she's standing in a garden. Why does she think he's a gardener? Because they're in a garden, and there's this alive man behind her. And here's the thing, is that the story that we just read about Genesis chapter 1, where all this started, began on the first day of the week in a garden with God cultivating order and beauty and goodness in this garden. And in the culmination of this, he placed his people in that garden and told them to go make a better world. Now here we are, thousands of years later, after the fall, after sin, after brokenness, and Mary standing in a garden. First day of the week, she turns around and she sees her resurrected Messiah, and she thinks he's a gardener. I mean, she thought he was a gardener. You have to see, like, he's not, like, accidentally making parallels here. What John is saying is that the resurrection, Jesus, all of this is not just about forgiving you of your sins and taking the bad things about you and tossing it to the side. The resurrection is about new life. The resurrection is about new creation, and so he places it in a garden with Jesus and one of his people, just like the beginning, God in a garden with one of his people. And so the task has been picked back up. We've been restored, right? Through Jesus on the cross and resurrecting and defeating death, we are restored and redeemed and set free. But not just back to before sin, all the way back to where we began, all the way back to page one, all the way back to the garden, all the way back to the initial purpose. The point of Jesus is that we are now free. And we're not just free from something bad, we're free for something. We are free for the opportunity to pick back up the initial task of being his image bearers, being his representatives, and going into the world and changing things for the better. A whole new world is coming into existence right here in the midst of this one. That's what the resurrection means. It means that the resurrection is. It is. And we are his new creation, and we are his restored humans who are to pick up the task that we've always had, which is being his image bearers. And so, everyone everywhere has a chance to be a part of it. Now, look, we tell people that this is good news, the gospel. It's good news. And then we tell them all the things that are wrong with them. And how this good news can fix them, right? But this story is so much more full of hope than that. It's so much more exciting than that. There's something wrong, and we think it can be fixed, or we think we can escape it. It's something more than that. It's that we get to engage in this world, and that every person that you ever meet has that opportunity to engage with you together in the name of Jesus Christ to go make a better world right here in the midst of this one. The resurrection is. And the way that you orient yourself to Jesus and to God in terms of how you understand your value and your being and what it means to be an image, man, it's going to affect the way that you think about yourself. It's going to affect the way you think about your purpose. It's going to affect how excited you are about your faith. And it's going to affect what you believe about the people that are standing around you. Because if you don't start in the right place, if we don't orient ourselves by starting with the initial purpose and seeing how Jesus fulfills that initial purpose and gives us the chance to pick it back up, if you don't start at the beginning and instead you start with sin and death and bad things, then you will see yourself as something that needs fixed. You'll see yourself as something that needs fixed. Something is wrong with me and I need fixed. And then you'll come into a relationship with Jesus. And because you think that's the point, you will think that a transaction has happened that has fixed you. And so you were somebody who needed to be fixed, but now you're somebody who used to needed to be fixed, but now you're fixed. And if you believe that about yourself, then you will start to see all the people around you as things that need fixed, just like you were. Come in here. Come into my tent. Come into these walls, and we will fix you. Come know my God. Oh, you struggle with that sin. You live that lifestyle. You've done those things. Come in here. Come in here. Come in here, and we'll fix you. You'll be fixed. Come on. Come worship my God. He'll fix you. Not only is that like degrading, man. Not only is that degrading, it's also very ineffective. Nobody wants to come to your church to get fixed. Nobody wants to come be a part of your God's plan for them to be fixed. Right? We understand that, right? Not only is it ineffective, but we've missed the whole point. We've missed the whole point because we are disoriented, because we started where we shouldn't have, and we didn't start all the way back. And so here's kind of the confusion that we get to when we view ourselves this way and when we view people that way. The point of this story, and you have to understand that the Bible from Genesis to Revelation at the very end is one unified plot line. The point of that story is not that everyone is a sinner, but we should love them in spite of that. It's not it. The point of the story is not that there's something wrong with all these people, but because I'm a Christian and because of Jesus or something, I'm going to love them anyways. It's not the point. Never has been. The point is that everyone that you meet is an image of God, and we should love them because of that. Every person that you meet has like an indescribable intrinsic value in their soul because they are images, idols, representations of the God that you worship. You understand that, right? The people that you meet every day that you don't like, that you do like, that you are nice to, that you're mean to, all these people are the holiest things that you will ever come in contact with until you meet your Creator. The holiest objects that will be presented to your senses are these beings that are His image, are His representation. And not only that, but every person that you meet, man, they have this ability to come with you and with your God in the name of Jesus to go make a better world right now, in this place, in this world. You believe that the resurrection is, that's the way that you will view people. That's the way that you will love people. That's why you will sacrifice for people. That's why you'll be urgent about sharing the exciting and good news about what it means to be a real human, a true human in God's good world, and the ways in which we get to take that into a better future. And my question is, you know, we're on the precipice here at 514 of moving into something bigger. And the question is, like, what kind of church will we be? What will we look like? What will the people here look like out there in the world? You know, will we be Genesis chapter 3 people? Like, do we think that there's just a bunch of stuff that are wrong with broken humanity and they need to come into this tent so we can fix them? Because we might get some people in the doors. We might. But you know, we'll never be a movement. We'll never be something that really goes out there, man, and changes things from the ground up. We won't be. But I think that, like, if we really believe that this world has always been good, and that we humans have always been supposed to co-rule it on behalf of God, and that our purpose is to take it into a better future, and every person that you meet is that image who has the ability to do the same thing, man, I don't see how we could be stopped. I don't see how we could be stopped. Forget a building, forget strategy, forget budgeting. I don't care. I really don't see how we could be stopped as a church. And so we need to wrestle with this, man. We need to wrestle with this in our own faith. Where have we begun? How have we oriented ourselves towards understanding who we are? Understanding who Jesus is and understanding who the people around us are, man. Wrestle with this, because I know that if you're conditioned to think of it as sin is the point and getting rid of sin is the goal, then it's really hard to back up. But we have to. We have to see it for what it is. And so we have to pray and we have to wrestle and we have to figure out what we believe and what kind of church we want to be out there with people who need to know Jesus and need to know the gospel and the good news of hope and purpose and love and identity. So I'm going to pray for us. And I've got a quick announcement at the end, so just hang tight. God, thank you for this community. Thank you for 514 Church. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to love this world on your behalf, to be the people that we were always supposed to be. And I pray that we take that vocation seriously, that we take the fact that we have this ability to transform the world around us and that we have this calling to do that, and that we do it for you and for your purposes in the name of Jesus. And I pray that you give us that strength and that power and that will to really wrestle and understand where we are starting, how we understand you and what that means for our lives. Give us that strength, Lord, and let us feel your presence this week. In your name we pray, amen.